Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're back with RCR Greenwashed with Jaspreet and Don, and it may have been published as a report, but it reads more like a horror story for New Zealand's farmers and rural communities, says Federated Farmers Meat and Wool Chair Toby Williams. And what's he referring to? Well, he's referring to a report released today by Our Land and Water National Science Challenge called Why Pines. And so we've got Toby on to talk about this because it's quite, in one way, it's quite an upsetting report, Toby. But what's your first take on it? Because the headline's pretty powerful when you talk about a horror story for farmers.
Yeah, it is. The headline really confirms what we've been talking about for the last, 4 or 5 years at Federated Farmers, that, the unchecked, desire to keep planting more pine trees to solve our climate problems is going to cause further problems downstream for rural communities, for our entire sheep and beef sector. It's competing in land within them. So, it has the potential, especially at a time now when sheep production is okay, but sheep pricing, our returns from sheep farming especially are very poor, and farmers are on edge, and it makes them really nervous when the government's making these rules up, or they're not changing rules fast enough, that it threatens their livelihoods.
Right. So do you think this report takes into account all the sunk investment that a farmer has already made, what the processing like the meat processors have made, the wool scares have made? Do you think that's all taken into this account? Because if it hasn't, then it's probably understating the massive thrust of pines all over the landscape.
Yeah, if I'm really honest, I think it probably understates it a little bit. It's very difficult to add in all those, all the extras that go along with farming. Our local vets, the processing plants, the bike shops, the utes. And if you look at rural New Zealand now, if you go and talk to these guys, you go to your local bike shop here in Gisborne, the sales are really quiet. Farmers like myself, my hands, I've buried my wallet and my hands are deep on top of it, and I've almost had to stitch my hands into my pants so you can't get your wallet back out again. That's how hard it is at the moment. And what we're seeing is more regulation, more desire to, to push for standards that aren't necessarily achievable. And the easiest thing for me to do is to go, you know what? I've got 130 years on my farm, but it's got too hard. I can get really good money and sell up and go and do something else with my life. I could go, and visit, on a world tour with the money in the bank from selling up, to an alternative land use such as pine trees.
Yeah. And so what do you think? I mean, this isn't something new. The forestry joining the ETS in 2008 from memory, and it's just been a slow progression to this next level of let's take out as much land as we can. I mean, the last six, from 2017 to 2023, they had the governance of this country was quite destabilizing. Why do you think they wanted to do this to your industry? Why? Because they have destabilized your industry again. And, from my point of view, I was one of the generation that resurrected the meat industry once before, from the largesse of the meat industry way back when we had 80 million sheep. Now we've got 24 million sheep, and there's still the players and politicians that want to destroy you. Why is that?
Yeah, we do wonder this. We talk about this in our group. What do we do? The general public consensus is that they love farmers. The farmers are held in high regard, that we produce food. Do we need to improve what we're doing on farm in terms of our environmental footprints and our emissions? Of course we do. But the concerns we're really having with the government is that the pace they want to do this is unachievable. And I don't honestly think, I think the government can see Greta Thunberg in the UN calling out New Zealand for being not doing enough. We had Nestle last week saying, New Zealand, you're not doing enough. Is there any country who's doing more than what we already are?
Well,
is there there isn't. And I think we just need to sit back to these guys and say, actually, we're doing a really good job. We're one of the most efficient producers of food in the world. We've got a very young country. We've got a very young history. We made some mistakes in the past, and we're moving forward with trying to change how we're doing this. But, I think the unintended consequences of where the government in the past has wanted to go they haven't thought about it well enough. They've got they've classed the light bulb that's gone off, and they're still clutching to it while their hands are burning.
Now, I'll play the devil's advocate here, Toby. I read that article by Nestle, and when this gentleman who was speaking via Zoom from Switzerland, he is their marketing guy, Bruno Speier. He said, when he was asked, "What do your customers want?" He said, "What our customers are asking for is that the product is safe and that the product is sustainable." And no one can deny that our products are safe and sustainable. But then he goes on to say in the next breath that the roadmap we have at Nestlé is to Nestlé reducing its emissions by 20% by 2025, 50% by 2030. And without Fonterra or New Zealand playing its part, Nestlé will not be able to achieve its objectives. So it's not the average mom and dad consumers wanting it. Anyone who's going buying a bar of chocolate or say something on similar lines, they're not wanting it. Anyone who's picking up a pack of instant Nestlé Maggi noodles, they're not wanting it. We have allowed for too long for our industry leaders, I think, to just play along and tie us up in these knots of constantly saying you need to do more. It's like telling an Olympic champion, someone who's at the gold medal level, or even if you won a bronze at the Olympics, do more. Seriously? At that level, to get the smallest amount of improvement takes a whole lot, and no one has economically priced this. When is our industry going to say, no, we just can't do this? This is not achievable.
Yeah, I don't think the New Zealand way is to say no, it's not achievable. I think as a farmer in New Zealand, we always say yes, we want to do better. We need tools to be able to do that. What we're sort of seeing at the moment is the protectionism out of Europe and out of America and out of India, all around the world, where they want to protect their farmers with subsidies. We've got international trade now. We can't just go slap tariffs on everybody. So with the formation of the WTO back in, was it 1970s, 1980s, we broke those tariff barriers down. So now what we're seeing out of other countries is far, New Zealand seems to be the only country in the world who doesn't care about their farmers. If you look at Europe, you can use the Dutch. They had these massive protests. They changed the government. A party rose up from nothing that was backed by farmers and then backed by the public who wanted to keep their food production when they brought on these really stringent rules. We've lost that a little bit in New Zealand. We've lost that, the farming lobby, we're still, it's still really strong. It's still there. The public support us, but it seems to have been lost. We've lost that, I suppose, mongrel in us, to sit there and fight a little bit for what we have. But I've said we need to keep moving. I do keep, no, we need to keep moving forward, and we shouldn't be looking at forestry as a concern. Forestry is important. It's a primary product. We should be looking, how do we add value to the forestry? There's no value in exporting raw logs. Like, we know our sheep industry became, after the Rogenomics era, our sheep industry became really successful because we got rid of the inefficiencies of tariffs. We increased our productivity. We stopped exporting whole frozen carcasses to Britain, and we started to cut them down into retail packs going direct to consumer in the United States, all over the world. So we've got opportunities to do that as well. But it's really hard. As a farmer, we need to do better, yes, but it's not helpful when you've got a multinational company saying you need to do better when you're already the best. If we New Zealand, if we stood up and said to Nestlé, you know what? Go and buy your milk powder somewhere else. Where would they go?
But at the same time, are we actually calling out the double standards in Nestlé? For example, one of the big buyers in countries like India, Nestlé's first factory was set up in India, in Punjab, the state where I'm from, in 1961. Tiny factory. Today, when I look at it, that factory collects 1.3 million kgs of milk per day during the flush season, with 110,000 farmers in India selling milk to Nestle. India doesn't have a national herd scheme. Foot and mouth is rife. No one can tell you, depending on which government website you look at, anything from 40 million to 60 million ruminants. There is nothing there. For Nestle, and similar is the state of affairs where for Nestle suppliers in China. Until they come up and they match our standards, why are we still being pushed? That's my question.
Yeah, well, it's a really good question, but I think we should, if the rest of the world ever catches up to us, then we haven't done our job well enough. We need to stay ahead of the world. If we want a premium for our products, we still need to stay ahead. That's been our comparative. We grow grass better than ever. We've got a very incredibly safety record in terms of our food supply in the world. I'm not saying we don't need to be going down the rabbit hole of the extremes where the government wants to go us at the pace they need us to go there. We still need to be moving forward. We've always got to be pointed in that direction. So how do you stand up to these big companies? It's a really challenging thing. Farmers, we want our Fonterras to stand up. We want our Silver Fern farmers to stand up. But what we're finding is the directors, maybe they know more than us. They come back to us saying, well, they don't want this. What we do know is that if you go to a supermarket, what's your number one thing? You can go in there with all the aspirations in the world, and
Price.
you can see a price, 100%. It is always driven by price. And that, in the current environment, every one of us almost is driven by price. I'd love to walk into the supermarket and go, I'm just going to buy a steak today because you know what? I really don't care. I look at the steak and go, I could afford steak. I'd really enjoy it, but I've got a family to feed. I've got a budget to live to. I've got a mortgage to pay. I can't, once in a while this is going to be nice. And what am I best spending my dollars on at the moment? And if it's cheaper, you're going to buy it. It's as simple as that, no matter where it's come from. I'd love to buy free range chicken, but I don't. I go and buy the same chicken as everybody else does.
Well, Toby, just a bit of history. I recall about 2007, which was around the year that I decided to hell with sheep farming. It was the worst year in 50. And yeah, maybe you're having years as bad again now. But a local processing company told me the best money he made that year for his shareholders was to buy old ewes, slaughter them, blast freeze them, cut them in two, and send them to India. That was his best margin product of the year. So you talk about value add, I tell you it's all about value capture. And I tell you, you can't, that's the trouble with the directors you just talked about. They've got us tell it, they're good at telling us we need to do more. But I only ever want them to capture value. If they're going to add a whole lot of costs and not capture the value, well, they might as well just leave it in the raw state and sell them as whole carcasses again. That's the
100%.
problem.
Yeah,
That's the problem.
there's a really clear example of that and how our major meat processors work. So we've got on one end here, we've got Silver Fern Farms. So I'm a Silver Fern Farms shareholder. I support the direction they want to go, plate to pasture, and all of this. And I'm actually getting good premiums. We're taking a lot of hoops, jumping through the hoops, ticking the boxes to get these extra premiums and to get more money for our protein that we send there. Then you've got Alliance sitting there in the middle who do a little bit of everything. But then we can go down to EFCO, Tally's own EFCO. Tally's are an incredibly successful business because they know they do one thing really well, get it in and out. And part of the issues we've had with the Alliance have had is they've bought expensive meat, and they've held on to it, hoping the price is going to come right. And the price has continued to slide. As all of a sudden, your expensive meat, what you've paid for it and what you can get for it, the margin widens. So you can take the EFCO model where it is in the door today, sold tomorrow. If I make a profit on it, brilliant. I'm not, if I make a loss on it, it's going to be a small loss because you've got small fluctuations. So I totally agree. But I think one of the things with our meat processors we've got to look at is that have they done a good enough job of diversifying our markets and figuring out where that value is?
Well,
And I'd probably argue they haven't.
we've been
No.
told they have for 40 years. So look, each year is different. Everything has to evolve, Toby. But it's never good enough, it seems. I think we need to go back to where we started this conversation, and that is with this report. The report on the Our Water, Our Land, Our Water National Science Challenge on and the Why Pines report says that meeting the current freshwater bottom lines will require widespread land use change from farming to forestry. Now, yeah, what is the link between pine trees and freshwater?
Yeah, that's a really good thing. So I think what they're saying is that we need to convert 20% of sheep and beef farms into pine trees to clear up, on average, our fresh water. We do know that if you take away ruminant animals off pasture, you can slow erosion down. You can also slow, there's no nutrients going back in, so we're not putting fertilizer on. It's washing out of the soil and down into waterways. So you are going to have, in inverted commas here, healthier waterways. Are they as amazing as a native forest in a pristine state? Of course they're not, because you lack the diversity. If you put a monoculture in there, you're going to have issues with that as well. The thing we've got to think about here is, great, let's put the pine trees in. We've done an amazing job. We've cleared up our waterways. In 30 years, when you go to harvest them, what's it going to look like? Those, I think, as a country, we're too short-sighted. We're looking at this from a very myopic spot. Like, we need to solve something really quickly. Let's plant it on pine trees. Let's do it for emissions. Let's do it for fresh water. Last year, in February last year, in March last year, on the East Coast where I live, we've seen what potential effects of poorly managed. I'm not saying the forest manager's done a bad job, but when we hold a spot to plant a lot of pine trees in, and there come time we need to then utilize those pine trees, we haven't thought about the harvesting process and the potential consequences that come out of clear felling massive catchments all at once. When you get these massive rain events, we see it all in stark contrast to what actually happens. We lose our bridges, our waterways are choked full of debris and sediment and things like that. So if we're going to be planting our waterways to improve, sorry, planting our farms and land to improve our waterways, we also need to have a plan about how we're going to utilize that in the future so we don't repeat these issues. I think what we should be looking to potentially more is how do we integrate it into farms, and how do we do it on farm more efficiently and using permanent native or permanent, exotics that are going to help to achieve these goals in the same way you would with exotic pine trees.
Gentlemen, I've been here only 15 years. I should qualify that with that, only 15 years. But what I've seen in this time, considering that my husband and I left India, banking jobs, to just go farming here, nothing else. That's all we came here to do, and that's all we've done till earlier this year. Between the costs being settled on, between, say, even if you look at Ministry for Environment, that went up from 320 staff to over 1,200 during the tenure of the last CEO, Vicky Robertson, to the environmental compliance, just getting market returns, that's one thing. But how much have the costs gone up? When I came in that year, minimum wage was 13.25, and I remember a $5 behind the milk payout was good. $5.90, our boss had just bought the farm next door, and he was like, right, I need to now build a bigger dairy shed, and we can do something here. I look at it now, $8 is nothing to write home about. There is nothing left. Have we looked at how much of our hard-earned income as farmers have been squandered by these companies? You have failed, I don't know, investment schemes by companies world over. You have golden handshakes. You have compliance coming at you like there is no tomorrow. Tick box this, sign this off. This is a 10 cents being retained for this environmental compliance, and so on and so forth. Our own companies are tying a noose around our own neck. It's not just markets or value capture here. The compliance capture has had a large part to do with this. I mean, I'm happy if either of you differ with me, but this is what I feel genuinely.
You're right, and you guys are down in South. It's a very different environment in Southland to what it is here on the East Coast. We've the land use is different. So I can speak to like our areas and what that looks like and the challenges we have here, which is very different. I think we need to, when we're looking talking about the environment, the one thing, I think the one big mistake that the previous governments have made is we've painted the entire country with the same
100%,
brush.
100%.
It is we aren't. What we have in Northland is different to South and to East Coast, to Taranaki, to the West Coast. We need to be looking at bespoke rules that suit our environments and that are actually going to achieve goals we set out there. And farmers in Southland or Otago or Canterbury, we've got to remember 15, probably maybe tw almost 20 years ago, and I'm not, no, not quite 20 years ago, were incentivized by the regional councils, by the district councils, by the government to put dairy farms in. It was subsidized. Fonterra had just been formed. It was how fast can you get this converted? We'll put some irrigation schemes and you guys grow amazing grass, But what we didn't think about, it's the same as pine trees here on the East Coast in the 1980s. We didn't think of what are the consequences of putting tens of thousands of dairy cows down on what used to be sheep farms. Sheep are, a relatively low environmental
Input.
impact compared to a cattle beast. And we're not saying there's a, the, but we didn't, what we didn't think about at the time was what are the consequences of this going to, what's it going to look like into the future? This is all catching up with us now. And the unfortunate thing is the government, the previous government, tried to catch it all up in a 3-year period, and they haven't got it right.
Well, you may be unaware that the sheep and beef farms in the South Island were pretty terminal in that era because we were bailing out the Alliance Freezing Company to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. So things were terminal. And actually, the North Island didn't escape, but you certainly didn't feel it the way you'll
Right.
portray it. And you've made a statement that Fonterra was subsidised. Well, I'm not quite sure how you think that subsidy worked, because all I know is they got legislative privilege to form. That was if that's a subsidy. But that aside, the reason the dairy industry came to the South Island is sheep and beef farmers, meat and wool farmers, were on their knees,
Feeling.
and it was a best option. And it's one of my regrets that I never did it, because I'm in an area that could have done it. I thought, no, I'm going to hang out for the savior of the meat and wool industry that never came. So we had a couple of good years, but not many. But look, we could debate that all night. But we don't tell the story well enough. We don't tell in the world scheme of things that we're subsidy-free production systems here, and yet we have politicians and trade negotiators who are saying, "Oh, but if we tell the rest of the world that all the time, and if they became subsidy-free, we wouldn't compete." Well, I'd say bring it on. Then we'll change our land use. We'll do something different. But I want to go right back again, because we seem to get off this track, to these fresh water rules. What level are they? Are they, because it seems to me that under the David Parker Labor Party regime, the rules were put in to make standards for our fresh water that were virtually unattainable, even in the most pristine headwaters of our West Coast rivers. And I'm aware of being accused of defending poor performance by one of the well-known antagonists about water quality in this country, and he labelled a certain river. Actually, it had no animals, no human habitation in it. Shot himself in the foot, but he never apologised. These people, the people that are giving us a lot of grief about freshwater rules, often play to the audience, and they seem to have captured us all in this. And hence, you've got this report out saying that we got a diminished 20% of our land to get their aspirations back on track. The aspirations seem to have been badly founded or poorly founded, Toby, is what I'm getting at. And is that a concern that Federated Farmers is taking up with the government today to try and get some realism back in the equation?
Yeah, it's not one of the portfolios that sits with me, but it's one of our
No,
main
no.
focuses
Yeah.
is that, the rules around freshwater, aspirational goals are incredible, but you've got to set an aspirational goal that's achievable. And we're great at talking about aspirational goals, smoke-free 2025, pest-free 2050. Let's bring our waterways back to the standard that we were before humans even got here. A really great example of what you're talking about was down in Canterbury. Where we're talking about nitrates in Canterbury, and there was a particular river. I'm not sure which one it was, but the nitrates coming out of up in the Southern Alps and unfarmed, never been farmed. It's the nitrates naturally coming out of the water are higher than what the limits were set by the government, and this is where you come. We need to. I suppose the biggest failing is what we don't understand is. Where are the issues? We haven't monitored. We've got not enough monitoring. We saw on in the Wairarapa Regional Council, and well, what's the Wellington Regional Council up there, talking with the freshwater. They took 3 or 4 tests, and they extrapolated out across an entire region and said, "This is from these couple of tests. This is what this entire region looks like." They didn't bother going and looking at all the tributaries and doing because it's expensive to do the testing. So they thought, well, computer modeling can do it all for us. We've got to be putting quality data in. So I think the first step for us in water quality is understanding what is our water quality? Is it actually as bad as we say it is? Are we willing to put our hands in the air and say, hey, stop for a minute here. Let's get some pottles. Let's go and sample it at set times of the year and set locations going up all of our waterways and measure actually what we've got. Because once we know, understand what we've got, then we can set some rules and limits around what we need to improve and how we need to improve it, and also where it's coming from. Because if it's already naturally at the source, like in this Canterbury River, you can't take that out. No, getting rid of all the dairy cows that go into that catchment aren't going to improve the nitrate levels in there because it's
And so
and and
that's, sorry, Jaspreet, I'll just say this. And that's why when the RMA was first enacted, everyone was worried about point source discharges. So stuff out of tiles, out of drains in a city or into a waterway from a farm or whatever, a processing factory. But that wasn't good enough. They then moved to talking about cumulative effect. So of course, as you've just said, the headwaters of a river add in, all the additional changes on the way to the sea are all added in. So by proxy, by default, you are all guilty. You're all roped into it, whether you're at the headwater at the sea. And to me, that was the killer blow, really, when they talked about cumulative effect. And we've been paying the price ever since. I mean, you talked about potholes of water testing. Do you think that hasn't been done?
hasn't been done. I can guarantee it hasn't been done. Not to the scale across every catchment that's required to understand what our water quality in this country actually looks like. And there are some catchments which are brilliant. I think there's areas in the Waikato who have done it incredibly well. There are areas in South that have done it really well. In Gisborne, where I live, I think they've got three or four of the rivers that they actually know. The rest of it is just assumed that's what it is. And it's not good enough, to put a bunch of rules onto people, onto businesses, and say you need to abide by these when we actually don't know what the problem is. And you've also got to then throw in an urban to the urban situation. We look at Auckland in the summer. How many beaches could you swim in Auckland in the summer? How many beaches in Wellington can you swim in the summer or at any point? We've got raw sewage flowing in. But yeah, we don't need to worry about that. Our councils will give themselves a resource consent to continue discharging while they think about how they're going to fix it for the next 20 years. Whereas a poor old farmer who has fenced their waterways off, have done a fantastic job of looking after things, are then going to be penalised by these rules and told you can't be in business anymore because we've set up these rules. You can't make them, so you go and plant your pine farm into pine trees and be done with it.
Yep, and that's what it is. No one looks at where the what's the contribution of urban New Zealand to all of this? If you look at us, our populations went up from 4.9 million to 5.3 in the last handful of years. What is the impact of that? And then again, what does success look like? It has the same problem. Urban New Zealand is facing the same problem with three waters being talked about and how much it's going to saddle the people, the rates rises over the next 10 years, the amount of borrowing councils will have to do. Maybe it's time to put a stop to this, put our hands up and say we want a full economic analysis of what we can afford, actually. And maybe we settle for that quality of water rather than aiming for this water nirvana.
Let's start with the worst areas first. Let's figure out where it's really bad and focus on those. And then we move our way up. We use it as a really good analogy that, you can't fix the catchment, you can't fix an issue in the catchment by starting at the sea and fixing the last property before there. You need to start at the top of the catchment and work your way down. Is it the Ruapehu, the Rangitiki River Catchment Collective, I think they are, which is one of the very first catchment groups to go from Ruapehu out to Whanganui River. We were talking with them, and one of the things they realised really early on is you can do all the work you like clearing the blackberry, the willows, the gorse off your property. But if the property above you is full of it still, you're going to spend the rest of your life, every time it floods, you're going to spend the rest of your life doing it. You need to target that top one first. Yes, the bottom one where everybody can see it's really important, but there's no point in fixing that till we fix the one at the top. It's the same with all of this environmental stuff. Let's find the worst spots. Let's target those first. Money's limited. Cash is tight. Unless someone wants to come in, we get an Elon Musk or whoever wants to come in and give us their fortune, to solve some of our issues. I think we'd find we'd be putting it into health medication and schooling before we'd be looking at our environmental goals. I think if the public, would be really keen to see that more than that. Not saying the environment's not important, but ask someone what they want first and foremost. Now they want a long, happy, healthy life and access to all these other things.
And if you ask the average New Zealander, do they want to see the country being, just vast swaths of pine converted into that? The answer would be no. This report that we are discussing here on ourlandandwater.nz called "Why Pines" was released recently, and it talks about the fact that the another concern in this whole suggestion of blanket converting into pines is that the environmental effects of pine forests and the possibility that we may be swapping one environmental problem for another, the same thing that you mentioned, Toby, harvesting and early regrowth, the impact of sediment and debris on waterway. Then they also go on to say that the indigenous vegetation that still exists in New Zealand is in small pockets on sheep and beef farms, providing an important biodiversity refuge that would be degraded if pines replace farms that maintain these pockets. And pine trees can invade many native landscapes across farm boundaries, and the net effects of pine forests and biodiversity require careful consideration. And this is before we even go to the fact that they want the ETS terminated, and if the price of carbon drops, what's going to happen to all those pine trees and people's fortunes effectively?
Exactly. I think, I said earlier, we've got a very short-sighted view in our country. The current energy crisis is a case in point. We do it just as we need it. Our roading infrastructure, Auckland Harbour Bridge is probably the best example anywhere. We'll build a four-lane bridge over. Sydney builds a six-lane, and in America, they build like 12-lane ones, knowing that it's going to grow. And we just clip things on until you can't clip things on anymore. We need to be thinking about what is our end use for these pine trees. If you go and talk to a forestry advisor, and I did this, we've got a 50-hectare paddock we're going to plant to do something with the back of the farm. It's very steep. It's unproductive. It would be better in some form of vegetation. And we had some concerns around harvesting, what it was going to look like, whether we're going to be able to. We've got a sensitive catchment we go into. It's got a marine reserve at the bottom of it. And they said to me, "Now you'll be right, mate. You'll be able to harvest it." Because in 30 years, he's not going to be working in the same role.
No,
He
he's
doesn't
not.
care. He's getting paid now. All of the consultants are getting paid now. They're not going to be there to pick up the consequences of what we're currently looking at. The legislators that we've got there are the same thing. They're not going to be there. So we've got to think, how do we build a market around these? And if you look back when we built Kawerau, Kawerau, the township was built around the forest, built around the mills. Okay, they're struggling now for the mills we built. We don't need those things anymore. We don't need newsprint. We don't need all these. So we need to re be rethinking about this. One of the things we're not thinking about is how do we invest for the future and utilize these products to develop to deliver, value back to our country and products to the for the world to utilize to grow an income. If we put pine trees in, where does New Zealand get its income from in the next 30 years that sheep and beef would have provided?
And that's the key point here, Toby. Aside from all this ETS nonsense, and well, I call it nonsense because it's all legislative, non-market, really. It's a faux market. It's fabricated, and a lot of people making a lot of money out of it. Yeah, the carbon price is going to be shorted. Sorry, the carbon units that the government's going to release this year are going, or auction, are going to be reduced. So they're trying to force the market higher, just by the sheer volume of. Lesser volume of units. That's one issue. On top of that, we've got reports like this coming out. This report, by the way, looking at it, the elements of it cost about 2 million. I mean, you wouldn't have had to be a rocket scientist to know what's going on. You could have
Job
done this for
schemes.
$2. You could have done this for $2, Toby, with your
We could have
knowledge.
come in, they could have come paid a $780 Federated Farmers membership, and we would have told them it.
And of course, going the next step, I almost had a brain. I almost had my Biden moment there. I was having a brain fade. New Zealand has no really big next new industry. It hasn't had one for years. We need a Gina Rinehart in a New Zealand to actually say what we've got to do, because we actually have a lot of people think they know what we've got to do, but they haven't a freaking clue. And New Zealand does need to find other industries. Instead of whipping the land industries the way they do, because we're fair game. The unearned increments that come out of every kilogram of milk that's produced, or every liter of milk, or every kilogram of lamb, that's why you're struggling to be profitable and doing what you really want to do, which is be a good producer of trusted and safe meat and have wool as well. So, look, Toby, I love your enthusiasm. Actually, it's a breath of fresh air, and great to have you on RCR. We've had a chunk of your time, and we hope to get you back, because this is the sort of story we need to get out around our listeners and anyone that's everyone that we get to listen extra learn something, I'm sure. So fabulous having you on RCR today. Thanks Toby.
Thank you very much for having me. And can I just draw one sort of quick parallel to what you talked about? You know, when you, the Southman, finished up sheep and beef farming, it was really tough. You know, and you converted to dairy. What we're seeing now is exactly the same thing, except we're not converting to dairy, we're converting to pine trees.
That's right.
Yep. The parallel in there is, you know, we're just 20 years down the track from where we were. It's history repeating itself. We've got to make sure we learn from the past.
And the common denominator in that is non-market meddlers called politicians and bureaucrats. That's the common denominator. Hey, all the best, Toby. All the best for your next season. But we're going to talk to you before your season's over. We'll see how your fortunes are later in the year.
Yeah, thank you very much, Don. Thank you, Jasper.
Goodbye. Thank you.
See you later.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.